Books and Arts. Today you'll meet the great Chilean novelist Isabel Allende. In science fiction, we review the new one from Andy Weir, the writer who brought us The Martian, and you'll visit Adelaide's Tarnindi Festival of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Art. Hi, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're so very welcome to Books and Arts. And this is a song about a young Aussie soldier who loses a leg and his best mate when a mine explodes in Afghanistan.
In the ring they call me Warlord, my mother calls me Paul. You can call me Private Warren when you're filing your report. As to how I came to be here, this is what I understand. In this hospital in Germany, from the dust of Ura's gang.
You just turned 28, just bought a new car, when you joined the 1st Battalion of the Big 1RAR. We were next up for deployment into South Afghanistan to combat the insurgents and the dust of Ura's gang.
Yeah, Lee Kernaghan and Fred Smith there with the dust of Ura's gang. Well, on Anzac Day, we gather at dawn and we bow our heads in reverence to the fallen. And then for most of us, it's over. But for the other 364 days of the year, there are men and women across Australia who can never quite get war and all it means out of their heads, who are wounded in ways that they and their families have to face every day. And some of those people are artists. They paint, they sculpt, they make photos. Now a bloke named Mark Johnston is pushing to establish a veterans art museum. He even has a home marked out for it, a grand and lovely Art Deco building that's been vacant for a couple of decades and which is known in good military style as 310SKR. Mark, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Michael.
Nice to have you here. So we should talk about your own background first. What's your own background?
I spent some time in Melbourne in school, but then went off to join the Army, and I was in the Army for 12 years.
Yep.
And served around Australia and did some time overseas in the peace monitoring mission in Bougainville before I left the Army in about 2000 and moved down to Melbourne with my family.
Right. And why are you so fired up about this?
This cause around veterans arts is really about the quality of life and well-being of veterans and their families. And for many veterans, they have been touched in one way or another through loss of some form. And for me, it's both the suicide amongst the veteran community, but also quite personally, friends that I know have suffered in various ways. And one in particular is a terrific friend from my time at RMC Duntroon. And he was badly injured in a vehicle accident in the mid-90s, and he's been totally blind ever since, since 1995. And for me, and to be able to support people like him, and it pains me to say that I cannot yet support this man in a way that allows me to channel him into creative outcomes.
Yeah.
And there are many others like that we're trying to support.
So you've got a lot of faith in the use of art as a therapy. You both want to display art in this museum and also to make it a sort of centre for art therapy. And I know that the work you've done already has just been recognised in the Vic Health Awards last night. What happened there?
Well, that was tremendous. Earlier this year, we held our inaugural art exhibition titled A March to Art, Identity, which was a collection of 18 veterans and family members exhibiting on Collins Street here in Melbourne. And that was grounded in the realisation or the message that identity is central to the well-being of veterans and their families. And it ultimately goes to the heart of, or part of the issue around suicide.
And what do you mean by identity when you say that? What are we talking about?
The identity of an individual in terms of who I am, what do I represent, what are my values. And so for people still in uniform in the military, it's pretty clear for the vast majority of them who their identity is. But when you leave the military and take off that uniform, you've ostensibly left that family and you're on your own. You still have your family, most likely. But what do you do? What do you represent? Who are you? And the identity message is it's in the hands of the veterans themselves and their families, of course, to create their own identity. And there have been countless veterans in the past who have done that through art.
Mm. So you want to establish this National Australian Art Museum at a place called 310 SKR, which actually stands for 310 St Kilda Road.
That's right.
In Melbourne. But the military call it 310 SKR because that's the kind of thing the military like to do. So for 20 years, this extraordinarily beautiful Art Deco building right alongside the old military headquarters there in the beautiful blue stone building, the Victoria Barracks, this building has been empty.
That's right, yeah. So
you've put your hand up and said, oh, well, I can use that. Give it to me, please.
Yes, well, when we discovered it over 4 years ago, the person who took us through it said, you know, if you can come up with an idea for this, then see how you go.
The trouble is we've now broadcast it across the nation and everyone's thinking, ooh, what could I do with some real estate in St Kilda Road, Melbourne?
I have no doubt. But the history of this particular building is that it was made for veterans and made for veterans' wellbeing as a repatriation clinic. And given that it's next to an operating military base, it's across the road from the Shrine of Remembrance, and it's within the Melbourne Art Precinct and very accessible to the CBD of Melbourne, what better use for it than a Veterans Arts Museum?
You've just created a Venn diagram that puts you at the centre of the cosmos. You can't lose. Let's talk some more about art therapy. Also with us is Dr. Patricia Fenner, who runs the master's degree course in art therapy in the Department of Public Health at La Trobe University, which is in Melbourne. Patricia, welcome.
Thanks, Michael.
Now, look, in the 1980s, I interviewed a lot of First World War veterans for a history project I was doing, and only one or two of them, it seemed to me, thrived in war. I mean, there were people who loved war and who talked about it with great relish. Most of the blokes I spoke to talked about the horrors which they'd seen and cried. You know, I was a young man who'd spent a lot of time weeping with old men. And they often said to me, look, I've never talked about this stuff before, not even to my mates, about the terror and the horror they'd seen. What do you how could we make sense of, or how, give us a sense of what do you think is the proportion of men and women who come back from war with those kinds of demons? Is it most? Is it some? What do you think is the situation, Patricia?
Well, I think lived experience of trauma of any kind will impact on absolutely everybody who engages in conflict, combat-related conflict, whether they survive, they come out of that with a diagnosable trauma-related illness like PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is another thing. People adapt and cope with situations very differently. But the relevance of dealing with such a significant event in any person's life who's gone into a combat zone, I think, can be applied across the board.
What do you reckon, Mark? I mean, my grandpa was on the Somme. And he just seems to have come home and wiped the blood and mud off his trousers and got on with his life, whereas I've known other people in my family who wrestle with demons all their lives.
Well, it's important in my role that I never presume, Michael, to apply a label to anyone. As a veteran presents to me, I'll take them as is and try and channel them into a pathway that puts them on the road to a better place. In terms of numbers, there are statistics the Department of Veterans Affairs, Department of Defence have. I don't know them off the top of my head, but it's not overwhelming, but it is a growing number. Vietnam veterans, I think, are probably a bit of a standout in society today in terms of the numbers of Vietnam veterans who have been impacted adversely by their service. But it's a very difficult thing to say.
Hard to put a number on. All right. So, Patricia, this idea that art can be a therapy, just talk me through this. Because I can see that going to an art class would be a calming thing and an enjoyable process to go through. But the question I want to ask is, does it have a long-term benefit, or are you just spending a calm afternoon doing some painting? Do people walk out of that room, you know, after a time, after going through some kind of therapy, and actually show a long-term benefit?
Look, I think you have to think of it from a couple of perspectives, Michael. There's the kind of effect of using art materials in the immediate moment. We know from early stages of research that there is a beneficial effect to stress levels for just using art materials in very simple ways. And we also know that it induces a desire to keep doing that. The longer term effects probably are more attached to what meaning it creates for the person who's doing the work. One's the more mechanical side of things. The other component is what sense is this creating for me in my world, the work that I'm actually doing.
So that question Mark was asking before about who am I now?
That's
now the war
right.
is over. Who am I in the world?
Very relevant. The notion of identity underpins probably, you could say, all art making and art therapy related to trauma, because whether it's combat related or another kind of trauma, there's a fracturing of identity, who I was before, who I am now. And that needs to be attended to. It doesn't just fall back into place for many people. So art is one of those areas that permits a gentle, slow recreation of meaning, making sense of what's happened, because sometimes meaning can't be made, and actually forming a post-event identity. I think that's really important. And I'd like to add to that, there's also a neurological element to this without getting too technical, but art making bypasses verbal processing. We know that in the brain, and it creates access to parts of the brain where emotion and imagery are activated. And this makes it a much more palatable way to actually engage with internal kind of processing than talking.
How strong is the research that shows that?
Look, I think in the neuroscience, this is well accepted, what I've just talked about. Art therapy itself is developing the evidence on a larger scale for its own processes. But trauma researchers internationally certainly back up the neurological side of things.
Now, Mark, we've explained that this museum that you want to open would run these kind of services. There would be therapy there. It'd be a place to come to. And this building was built to look after veterans in exactly this kind of way. It would also be a museum displaying art. So you'd have to get your hands on some art. You've got to put something on the wall, mate. What are you going to show?
Absolutely. Well, veterans, we've already established in quite a collection. So our inaugural exhibition, we've attempted to retain the vast majority of that, which is just terrific, both for the veterans or the artists themselves, the veteran artists as we call them, whether they're family members, and ourselves to establish that initial collection. We can't go too overboard until we actually have a facility like 310 SKR to store it.
Yes.
But we also have a tremendous national collection, like in the State Library, the War Memorial, the National Galleries of Victoria and Australia, and other places, private collections. The contribution of Australian veterans to the Australian cultural landscape is extraordinary, and we really want to bring that out into daylight.
So there are some big names who've
Absolutely.
Been veterans. Just run some by us.
On the $10 note, Banjo Patterson was a writer of some note. He was a major in World War I. Sidney Nolan, Arthur Streeton, Clifton Pugh, to name a few.
Sidney Nolan didn't like the army, though.
He turned up on the day to put on the uniform, Michael, and he served.
Yeah. Albert Tucker, he's another one.
Oh, absolutely. And many of those are Melbourne boys as well.
Yeah.
And some lesser known ones, but probably I call him the grandfather of veterans arts, was a Melbourne boy, Napier Waller. He has no less than 11 public art installations around Melbourne.
Yeah. Came back from World War I minus an arm.
Correct. Yes.
And learned to paint all over again with his wrong hand.
That's right.
Yeah, extraordinary story. Yeah, Patricia, as we wind up.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind just adding to that we should. It's worth paying attention to the fact that people view these works and the impact this has in relation to educating the public about this role that people play in the army and other related fields. Art can be a therapeutic engagement purely by viewing as well. It may not be art therapy in the technical sense, but it's definitely therapeutic. And there's a public health message there.
Yeah, and it tells the rest of us a story that we need to hear.
Can help reduce stigma.
Just as we wind up, Mark, briefly, who needs to be convinced of this? For you to get the building, basically.
We're currently waiting for the state government to make a decision as to whether they'd like to take it off the federal government. And so I implore the Premier, Daniel Andrews, to to give us an answer. That'd be just terrific.
Right. So it's in his in tray.
I'd like to think so, yes.
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you to the two of you for coming in. It's such an interesting topic, this. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michael.
Appreciate your time.
Mark Johnson is a serviceman, ex-serviceman, who is driving a campaign to establish an Australian National Veterans Art Museum. And Dr. Patricia Fenner runs the master's degree course in arts therapy in the Department of Public Health at La Trobe University. I'd love to know what you think of this. You can talk to us on Facebook. You'll find all the details there on our website.
You're listening to Books and Arts on RN. Your host is Michael Cathcart.
Well, The House of the Spirits was the first novel by the Chilean-American writer Isabel Allende. It was published in 1982, and you and I will be talking about it this month in our Latin American book club. Since then, Isabel has written many, many novels, including Eva Luna, Inés of My Soul, and The Japanese Lover, as well as memoirs. Her latest novel is called In the Midst of Winter. She's speaking here to Kate Evans from a hotel room in America on a rather crackly phone line.
Isabel Allende, very nice to speak to you again on RN.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, last time we spoke, it was about your novel, The Japanese Lover. And while I can see some similarities, it seems to me In the Midst of Winter is a very different novel. What do you think?
Yes, I think it's very different. Although both stories happen in the United States to people who have come from other places, and there is a love story in The Japanese Lover. The lovers are like 80 years old. In this one, they're in their 60s, but still, it's mature love.
The Midst of Winter, it's so very cold in Brooklyn as your novel opens. What does all that snow do to the city of New York?
Well, it really happened. In January of last year, there was a blizzard and a snowstorm that paralyzed the state of New York for almost 3 days. And my book begins with a quote by Albert Camus that says, "In the midst of winter, I finally found within me an invincible summer." And that is like the thread of the book. It's the story of three people who are living in a sort of emotional winter. And the metaphor for the emotional winter would be the blizzard in Brooklyn in this case. And something happens to them and the invincible summer eventually emerges.
You also play around with that idea of winter very strongly in this novel. So there's a storm outside, but you bring these three characters together to tell stories. And that seems like such a primal sort of image, sheltering from the storm, telling each other their life stories.
Yeah, and it has a little background. Many, many years ago, I was stuck in a snowstorm in Chicago and I needed to get to a certain point and all the planes were canceled. So I went to try to rent a car. I'm a terrible driver and I can't follow instructions. And this was before GPS. So you can imagine how ambitious my plan was. But I got to rent a car and everybody had the same idea before. And there were no cars. There was only one car and three people in line. I was the first one. So the other ones were two guys. And so I said, I'll rent the car, I'll pay for it, but somebody else drives. And so we agreed, and the three of us were caught in this storm for hours and hours in the snow. Very, very cold. And I said, look, we're going to be here for hours. Let's tell our stories. I made up a story for myself, and I don't know if the guys did the same. But we spent the time telling stories, maybe real stories, maybe invented, I don't know. And then I always thought, someday I'm going to use this idea of three people stuck in a storm telling their stories.
Well, let's talk more about those three people. And how deeply does that cold seep into Lucia's bones? Tell us about her.
Well, Lucia, these three characters are living in an emotional winter. The three of them have been traumatized in the past. And they cope with it in different ways. One of them is Lucia Maras, who is a Chilean writer and journalist whose brother was arrested and disappeared during the time of the Pinochet dictatorship. She had to go into exile. She lived abroad for a long time. And she returned to Chile to research about the brutalities that were committed during that time and trying to find out what happened to her brother. So, and she has gone through cancer, divorce, the death of her mother. Everything has happened to her, but somehow she keeps herself going. She's still a feisty woman.
She's very vibrant. She's quite a big presence.
She's still very vibrant, but she's hurting very badly. And she's alone, and she doesn't like to be alone. The other character is Richard Baumeister, who is a professor at NYU, the University of New York, and he's a man who has a sheltered life. He doesn't want anything to happen to him. He doesn't take any risks. He's insured against everything except his own nightmares. There's no insurance for that. And he's a vegan. He has four cats. And nothing can happen to him until it does, because life eventually always catches up with us. And the third character is a young woman, an illegal immigrant from Guatemala, who lives in hiding. And she's silent, mute, invisible. That's the way that she copes with her trauma. So these three people are caught in the storm, and they are caught in a situation in which they have to make a decision. And they opt for solidarity, for compassion. They open their hearts, and something happens then.
So these three storytellers, as you say, Lucia is from Chile, Evelyn's from Guatemala, and Richard's story connects both to Brazil and to Jewish exile.
Yes.
It almost feels as though you're revisiting all of South America's political stories in this book.
Not all.
Well, not all.
I mean, people of my generation, we've gone through a lot. In South America, we've lived through decades of horrible dictatorships, of masses of people running away from their country and trying to find asylum in other places, immigration. And now we live in the United States, where we have thousands and thousands of refugees. Here they call them illegal aliens, but the truth is that most of them are people who are running away for their lives.
Yes, because Evelyn's story of violence, the impact of the narcos in Guatemala, escaping over the border through Mexico, it's so awful, it almost felt like an ancient story, but this is all still happening, isn't it?
Well, I have a foundation, and my foundation deals with several of the organizations that we support have to do with immigrants and refugees in the United States and abroad. So the case of Evelyn Ortega is something that we have seen in the foundation. It's not something that I made up. So it's very, very current. It's today's news.
And although your novel is imbued with these political and powerful stories of both the present and the past, I should admit I also found some of your novel terribly funny, almost like a caper movie meeting a road trip. And it shouldn't be funny because there is a dead body in the story.
Life is always funny. We are absurd creatures. So in the midst of winter or in the midst of tragedy, there is always humour. That has been my experience.
Yes, because there's a sort of almost a car chase through the snow with encounters with a moose. And I have to say the moose did make me laugh out loud. But Isabel Allende, this is also a love story. And am I right in thinking this is also partly your own love story that you're drawing on?
Not really, because when I wrote the book, I did not have love in my life. I was going through one of those long winters. My marriage had failed. The last few years of my marriage were not good. And I had just divorced my husband after 28 years of marriage. And it was a sad moment. It was like confronting the rest of my life. I'm 75. Confronting the rest of my life alone, which was not something that I wanted to do. Then my agent died, and she was like a mother to me. Three of my best friends died suddenly, and my dog, Olivia, died. So it was a long time of sorrow, of grieving. And so I started writing the book, and of course I exorcised all my own sorrow by writing. That's the way I deal with my own stuff. And then by May, when the book was more or less done, I mean, the outline was done, a guy that was a lawyer from New York, that was driving to Boston, heard me on NPR and emailed my office. And, my assistant answered, then he emailed the next day, and then the following day, and then we started corresponding. He wrote to me every single day, in the morning to say good morning and in the evening to say good evening for 5 months. And we never talked, and I met him 5 months later, and then he invited me out for lunch. I liked the guy, and I said, look, I am 75 years old. I don't have time to waste. Please tell me what your intentions are. The poor guy choked in the ravioli, but he reacted bravely. And to make a long story short, this was a year ago. I met him in October last year. He sold his house, got rid of everything he has, and he's moving to my house with his bike and his clothes. So starting January 1st, I will have love in my life, a new life. But I didn't have it when I was writing the book.
And yet,
which is very, you know, Kate, what is strange? That this man, who my sweetheart today, whom I didn't know, is very much like Richard. He's like Richard in temperament. So it is as if I had invoked him from the spirit world. It's very interesting.
And
it was a prophetic thing.
How much are you like Lucia? Because she is so full of warmth and possibilities and hope, despite the grief that has shaped her.
Lucia has a few things that resemble my own character, but I based her on a friend in Chile, a woman that was a writer and a journalist. Unfortunately, she had cancer, and then she had recurrent cancer, and she died not long ago. But it's a sort of homage to her and to women like her, because I know people like her. I didn't have to make her up either.
Isabel, I know you don't have very much time and you have an appointment to get to, but you mentioned Chile, and I wanted to ask you briefly about your very first novel, The House of the Spirits, because all this year on RN, every month, we're reading different novels from Latin America. And the next one, and in fact the final book in our Latin American book club, is your novel, The House of the Spirits. Mm. Why has it endured so well, do you think?
No idea. I always thought that that book was published in the perfect moment. And it was more opportunity than anything else, because many people have written many extraordinary books in Latin America, and they have not had the success that the House of the Spirits had. But it was published when at the end of the boom of Latin American literature, where the world was still conscious about the quality of our literature. There were no women in the boom. The fact that I was a woman was interesting. Also, I was called Allende at the time when Chile was in the news, after the coup, when people were talking about the brutality and the atrocities committed by Pinochet. So also that, I think, it served me well in a way. And then why the book has become this long-going success, I don't know.
You began it as a letter, is that right?
Excuse me?
You began that novel as a letter?
As a letter to my grandfather, which degenerated into a novel very quickly.
And is it still the case that you begin every new book on the same day that you began that letter?
Yes, it's January 8th. I've started all my books on January 8th. And of course, it could be considered superstition, but it's mostly discipline. I really need to carve the time, the silence, the solitude I need to write. And I do that with difficulty because I am pulled in every direction and my life is busy. But everybody around me knows that by January 7th, I'm preparing, and January 8th, I'm not available.
So you're only giving your new lover 1 week to settle in before you're in the study writing.
I know. I told him that. He doesn't believe me. He'll have a surprise.
Isabel Allende, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Kate. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. And I know you have another appointment to get to.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Gosh, January the 8th is going to be a big day at Isabel's house. You know, I've never heard of that before. In all the interviews that I've done with writers, I've never heard of a writer who always starts his or her novel on a particular day of the year. But January the 8th is the day that Isabel does it. Now, she doesn't know why the House of the Spirits is such a big success. So let's see if we can answer that question in our Latin American book club. We'll be talking about that on Thursday, December the 14th. And she was talking there to Kate Evans about the latest novel, which is called In the Midst of Winter. And that one is published by Scribner. Well, we're fast approaching the festive season, and with that in mind, let's find out what books RN presenters are recommending for your summer reading.
RN, best reads.
Hey there, Natasha Mitchell from ABC RN's Science Friction with my summer reading suggestion. So my pet interest over the years has always been the intriguing ways in which science intertwines with human culture. Actually, not just human culture, all species captivate me equally. So here is a book from one of the great scientific minds of our time, and it is a magpie mind at that. This writer collected ideas like they were jewels. He polished and crafted them as if a poet. And I'm speaking about him in past tense because somehow the acclaimed neurologist and writer Oliver Sacks has turned out a new book 2 years after his death. Now that takes talent. Or a small miracle. Although, of course, as a scientist, Oliver Sacks wouldn't have subscribed to the idea of a miracle. He didn't really need miracles to marvel endlessly at the wonders of the world. So the book, The River of Consciousness, is a collection of essays about minds of all kinds. Oliver's own mind, with delightful stories from his own life. Those of his patients, some of whom we've met before in Sacks's earlier, much celebrated books like The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and An Anthropologist on Mars. And then he considers minds of, well, other kinds too, worms and wasps, sea snails, jellyfish, protozoa, even plants. He reminds us that their unique sensory intelligence can't be forgotten either. From forgetting to remembering, creativity to consciousness, this is classic Oliver Sacks. Keep on writing, Doctor, wherever you are.
For more best reads, go to the RN homepage.
RN's Natasha Mitchell with her best read of the year, Oliver Sacks's posthumous collection of essays, The River of Consciousness. And after you've read that, you might like to read Insomniac City, which is a beautiful, wise and surprising book that takes you into Oliver Sacks's mind in another way through the eyes of his lover, Bill Hayes. An absolutely beautiful book, Insomniac City. In 1946, 800 Aboriginal pastoral workers in the Pilbara walked off the job, and the strike that they started there was one of the longest in Australia's history. It lasted 3 years, and it ended with better pay and conditions for Aboriginal workers. Well, Aboriginal artist Nyaparu William Gardner was a young boy when that strike took place, and that event is reflected in much of his work. His series Outside Man features lonely men, usually stock workers or miners, against a sparse Pilbara backdrop. Claire Nichols is with him at the Tarnandi Festival in Adelaide.
That's me sitting down, drinking on the west side, and drinking a cup of tea.
William Hill, or Billy, as he likes to be known, is showing me some of his work.
You can see the lot. And the Luma Hill's on the top. There's a hill over there. On the west.
As he tells me the stories of the paintings, he also describes in great detail the geography of the places they're set, memories of the Pilbara that sometimes stretch back to his childhood.
On the other side, it was a schoolhouse and people go stay. And we live this side. That was a long time ago.
And William Gardner is an artist at the Spinifex Hill Studios in South Hedland. The manager is Greg Taylor.
William's a very special artist. He was painting a lot in the European tradition of landscapes, and in the last couple of years he's focused more on a figurative practice, and he often depicts solitary men on a big landscape. I think a lot of these men are in between times and are from the 1950s and 60s. They're all from his memory, and the men often look like they're in some kind of distress, or they've had a very hard life. And he often describes them as drifters or outside men, and they're usually depicted in between work on cattle stations or on the early mineral explorations of the Pilbara.
Yeah, so this is really a story of this part of the world, isn't it, these works?
Yeah, I think so, and it's an underwritten part of Australian history, and I think that we're very privileged to see these figures and landscapes that are all out of his head from a time that wasn't really recorded very much, partly through accessibility and partly through heat. Yeah, this is part of Australia where that was maybe the last to be settled, because it is such a difficult country, and now it's because, of course, it's become very important to Australia's economy with the iron ore exports.
William's figures have a very distinct look in terms of their composition, their faces, their bodies. They're quite unique, aren't they?
Definitely. You can definitely tell a William Gardner figure, and sometimes they do have odd proportions, and this is partly due, I would speculate, on the fact that William, he only has one eye, doesn't have a lens at all, and he's almost blind in the other eye, so he has a very narrow field of vision, and you can tell that when you talk to him, and also when he paints, it comes in and out of focus a lot for him, so these sorts of things add to the strangeness of his figures. Often they seem a bit discombobulated.
That is such a challenge for an artist who can't see properly.
I think for some people, we have many artists at the studio, and I'm sure many have limitations in other respects as well, whether it's through having different abilities. But sometimes a lot of artists can turn this into a sort of weapon, because it adds an idiosyncratic layer, an individual layer to their art making. And I think William, he's not defined by that, of course. He's just a remarkable artist and musician and language speaker of the Pilbara. But yeah, this is an aspect that it helps to keep in mind when looking at his work, is that he can barely see.
Tell me a little bit about Spinifex Hill Studios. How many people are working out of this space, and what kind of work are they making?
We're in South Hedland in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. We have had a large growth since 2014, when we got a new studio. South Hedland itself has many different language groups, so therefore our art centre has many different language groups and many different styles. At the moment, we have about 40 core artists painting there. And by core artist, I mean someone who comes regularly, and we're trying to push to exhibit and sell work. And then we have about another 50 occasional artists, which might be family of people that are drifting in and out of town, or just someone who wants to have a go and be in the community.
And are there any defining characteristics to the work coming out of your studio?
I think the Pilbara in general has a very colourful and explosive palette at the moment, and that's sort of distinguished from other parts of Australia. Very strong painting culture at the moment too. I think Spinifex is starting to get a little bit of notoriety for its figurative work. William is at the forefront of that. We also have a very young artist called Lane Judicki, who's doing comic strips. Kelvin Allen is doing some really wonderful figurative work. And now William's own son, Zenith Gardner, is doing some very interesting work. So I think these four men are changing the art centre. And art centres across Australia historically have probably been female dominated, but we have a really good gender balance at the moment. And the men don't always have the permission to do these large cultural paintings. So they're telling more individual stories and things that they're attracted to, and quite often it's the human form.
Just finally, you've come down from South Hedland. It's a way to Adelaide. How exciting was it to walk into this space and see William's work up on the wall here at Tarnindi?
We're absolutely thrilled. It's been unthinkable, the growth that's happened in with the artist group. And William has become our most established artist and is now having a lot of attention, critical and market attention. It's really satisfying, and for him, his esteem as a man and as an artist has really grown through exposure like this. And he's at the end of his life in some ways, but he's at the very beginning of his artistic career and the much deserved appreciation for all the changes he's seen in his life, his ability to survive and be happy, and now the wonderful paintings he gives us, they're really incredible gifts.
It's been a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure.
And artist William Gardner's exhibition is called Outside Man. It's part of the Tarnindi Festival of Contemporary Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Art. And you can see it at the Art Gallery of South Australia until the 28th of January. Claire Nichols with that story. And don't forget to pop next door to the museum, because there's lots of good stuff going on there as well. This is Books and Arts from RN.
This will come as quite a shock to my crewmates and to NASA and to the entire world. But I'm still alive. Surprise. Here's the rub. It's going to be 4 years for another mission to reach me. And I'm in a hat designed to last 31 days. So I got to make water and grow food on a planet where nothing grows. But if I can't figure out a way to make contact with NASA, then none of this matters anyway.
Yeah, the indestructible Matt Damon there. That's from the movie The Martian, directed by Ridley Scott, adapted from the debut self-published novel by US author Andy Weir. It follows an astronaut stranded on Mars and his efforts to stay alive in an alien environment. Growing potatoes is important to the story, as you'll know if you've seen it. Well, now Andy Weir is back with a story called Artemis. It's set on the moon, and RN's Erica Vowles is a sci-fi enthusiast. Hello.
Hello.
I didn't know you're a sci-fi enthusiast.
Oh, very enthusiastic.
How long has this been going on?
Oh, since my childhood.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
When did it start?
I don't know. I think I was about 9. I can't remember when I first started reading sci-fi books, but it was early on.
What were the early ones?
Oh, things like The Chrysalids.
Oh, yeah.
John
Wyndham is The Chrysalids.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of John Wyndham.
Well, I wasn't pretending I knew. I knew.
So, yeah, a bit of John Wyndham.
But did you read Isaac Asimov?
I did. And look, some books you get through and some books you don't.
That's true.
And, the Foundation series. So, yeah, it was always kind of there in my childhood. But not just reading, also consuming television. For me it's both.
Mm. Let's talk about this novel, Artemis.
Artemis. So, it's the first human settlement on the moon. It's a series of domes linked together, and it's set in the 2080s, 60, 70 years in the future. And the moon base, it kind of runs on a bit of light industry, a bit of mining of resources on the moon.
A mixed economy.
Closed loop.
Yeah.
Safety systems are very important, and also tourists come up from Earth, experience what life is like on the moon. So that's the setting. And Weir does a very good job.
Forget Port Douglas. We're going to the moon.
We're going to the moon. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd do that.
Would you?
Absolutely. Yeah, I would. I wouldn't be an astronaut, but if we were at the point where you could actually go somewhere and, hang out in a nice hotel and then go into a spacewalk.
I'd want an aisle seat. I don't want the window seat if I'm going up in the spacecraft. I think that'd be too spooky. You're more of a thrill seeker than I am. So Jazz Bashara.
Yeah.
She's the main person.
Jasmine Jazz Bashara. So she's our protagonist. She's 20 years old. She was born in Saudi Arabia, but her and her father moved to the moon when she was about 6. And so, she's an interesting character. She's very intelligent. She's very plucky. And she's a bit down on her luck when we meet her. When we meet her, she's trying to be admitted to the prestigious EVA Guild. So that EVAs are like spacewalks. So imagine you're living on the moon. One of the main industries is tourism. You want to be involved in that sector to take people on spacewalks outside of the dome and on the surface of the moon. So that's a big gig that she wants to get into, but she fails. And so, you know, she has a bit of a miserable existence. She lives in this kind of like coffin-like room because, as you can imagine, space is at a premium.
Space is at a premium in space.
In space, on the moon. Yes. And so even though she's very intelligent, she could have been a scientist. And in a way, she's kind of like a practical engineer who's learnt on the job. She knows how to weld in space. When we meet her, she's a courier. And so that puts her in contact with some fairly nefarious people because she does a bit of smuggling on the side to make money because as if you wouldn't.
Oh, she's not carrying pizzas around in a warm box on the back of a little space scooter.
I think pizzas do come into it at some point.
Do they?
But mainly it's, you know, moving things from the ships that have just come up from Earth or, you know, ferrying personal items between people. And so she comes into contact with this millionaire kind of nefarious character, Trond, and she gets kind of drawn into an intrigue that kind of endangers a lot of people.
Let's talk about whether this is any good. So The Martian really is, it's nothing but a psychological thriller because this guy is all alone and he just talks to us, and it's astonishing that you could write a book about a man who basically grows potatoes. I mean, that's what happens in the whole, and the movie's like that too. It's just watching Matt Damon fertilising potatoes with his own excrement.
And other people's.
And it's terribly entertaining.
It is. It's fascinating.
Yes. So what's the psychological insight like in this one?
Well,
as bad as that.
I don't know that there is a psychological insight for this one. So the main character, look, you know, you've got to hand it to Andy Weir for going there and writing someone else's story or having a stab at it, you know, strong female protagonist. But I don't feel like she's any woman that I know or any woman that any other woman I know knows or whatever. She's not believable to me. She's kind of, you know, the term the male gaze. Well, the male gaze is all over this character. She's hot. She has lots of sex with lots of different people and everybody gives her a hard time about it. And I'm thinking it's the 2080s.
Right.
Aren't we at all liberated? But the way she talks about herself, her internal monologue is very kind of negative and self-depreciating, and it's just kind of not real. Unfortunately, I feel like Andy, you know, he tried to write a female character, but he's just kind of written a female character for men.
So it's a bloke's take.
It is.
Oh. And that's a bad thing.
Well, I think so, because it irritated me. Look, I finished the book.
Yeah.
It's a pacey book.
It's going to be made into a movie.
Yes.
Of course it is, because the other one went so well. Is it going to work? Will it work as a movie?
I think it will work well.
Oh.
I think it really will. I mean, just the setting, you know, you've got like, you know, sub-gravity conditions. You've got all these spacewalks. You're going to have like the outside, the interior. It's going to be fantastic. And as I was reading it, I was thinking this is going to make a great book. And it's very pacey.
A great movie, you mean?
Yeah, it's going to make a great movie because it isn't necessarily a great book.
The Dispossessed. Now, there's a book about the moon.
Yeah.
Ursula Le Guin.
Different moon linked to a different planet. But this is the thing about science fiction that I think is the hallmark of a good science fiction story. Does it plausibly take you to the future? And in doing so, does it tell you about your present in an interesting way? And are the characters interesting and believable? And I think Weir only kind of makes it with one of those three marks. Whereas, you know, The Dispossessed, it's interesting. It takes the blank slate of, well, what could you do with a moon? You could build a completely different society.
Yeah. I love science fiction for the same reason I love history, because it takes us to another place and another time, and it illuminates the differences in that place, but it also illuminates the way we are now.
That's right. And I feel like with The Martian, with Artemis, Weir doesn't really take us that far into the future. Like I said, we're in the 2080s and still kind of our sexual relations are the same. And it's the thing where the book is really good is that he really nails down the scientific detail. And that's what I love about it. Some people have criticised it for being a little bit...
I read a review that thought it was too geeky. It had too much of that research in it. Do you like that?
I liked it because it made the world believable for me. And, you know...
So you're not totally dissing this,
No,
are
I'm
you?
Not. I'm not. I'm not. I finished it. I don't finish every book I pick up.
Okay.
But one of the reasons why I finished it is, you know what? If you hit a bit of stodgy prose, but you want to finish the book, it's okay to skim read. It really is. It's not illegal.
No, it's not illegal.
And so for me, the scientific detail, how do you put out a fire on the moon? How do you build backup systems
that
are going to work?
So you'll never know when you might need that information, how you put a fire out. Open the window and let the vacuum in.
Someone's got to imagine this.
That would put the fire out. That's Artemis, published by Penguin Random House. So that's by Andy Weir. Mm. Now, talking of putting things on screen, you've been looking at The Expanse.
Mm.
And last night I looked at a little bit of The Expanse because I knew I was going to talk to you.
What do you think?
I thought it was great. So this is a big sci-fi. I didn't really get what the premise of it was. I just knew that there was a lot of shooting going on, a lot of really strong characters who spend a lot of time in sort of astronaut masks, often having their brains blown out so the blood splatters dramatically on the front of the visor. That's the kind of thing I got. But I thought, I've got to watch this. So it's available on a streaming service.
It is available on a streaming service. In fact, I have been eagerly anticipating this series because I've known it's been coming for a couple of years. I think the first season arrived last year. And it's fantastic. So it's based on a series of books. And the world, it's 200 years in the future. Mars has been colonised, but it hasn't been terraformed. So you've got to wear a spacesuit to go outside. But also, humans have pushed to the asteroid belt and beyond, and they've started to settle some of the moons of Jupiter, one of the moons of Uranus. And so there are all these tensions between Mars and Earth and Ceres, which is one of these asteroid settlements kind of beyond the belt. And the thing about this series that I love is that it's got really interesting, strong, believable female characters who just really capture you and you kind of fall in love with them and want to be their friend. And, you know, in contrast to Artemis.
I wouldn't fall in love with them and become their friend because they're not going to live very long from the ones I saw.
Look, there are characters that have made it from season one to season two, so hang in there.
Okay,
hang in there. So, yeah, it's really enjoyable. And as far as I can tell, sticking as well as you can to the kind of canon of the books.
Right. So I loved Battlestar Galactica, which I binge-watched, I don't know, one summer, but 5 or 7 or 8 years ago. So if I enjoyed Battlestar Galactica, will I enjoy this?
Look, that's what a lot of the kind of critical reviewers have been saying. It's the best thing since Battlestar Galactica. And as far as I'm concerned, yes, it is the best sci-fi TV series to come along since Battlestar Galactica. It's not as good as Babylon 5, which to me is one of the best sci-fi TV series. But it's very good. And, yeah, highly enjoyable, great strong characters. I mean, there's just so many of them.
We should have a whole show dedicated to sci-fi.
We really should, I'd like to co-host it with you. But, for instance, you know, in the first season you've got Naomi Nagata. So she's like this belter. So there's this whole culture in the TV series about what would it be like to be born and living in the asteroid belt and beyond. And so she's like a chief engineer and she bosses all the men around. Mm. And there are so many, I can't even kind of list them all.
And Erica Vols works with us here at RN. And as I've just discovered, she's a sci-fi enthusiast. She knows a lot about it, doesn't she? So we were talking about Andy Weir's Artemis. That one's published by Penguin. And you can see The Expanse, that television series. It's on Netflix. Well, thanks for your company here on this RN podcast. Don't forget the Latin American Book Club. We're talking about The House of the Spirits by Isabel Allende on the 14th of December. Love to know what you make of it. You can talk to us on Facebook. I'm Michael Cathcart. And this is RN. Bye-bye.